Welcome to Real Truth for Today with Pastor Jeff Shreve, Senior Pastor of First Baptist Church in Texarkana, Texas. Now, here's Pastor Jeff.
Well, good Thursday morning and welcome to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here. Hope you're having a great morning. It's a beautiful day in Texarkana, Texas. We've already had our Strong Foundations group. It meets on Thursday mornings here at First Baptist Texarkana for young husbands and dads. We want to help those guys navigate the difficult waters. They're in the trenches with young marriages and young families, taking care of little kids, so difficult. And we want to pour into those guys and encourage them in the battle for their families, because it is a battle, and we want them to do well. Well, Proverbs chapter 21, verse 15, it's a favorite verse of mine. It says this: the execution of justice is joy for the righteous, but is terror to the workers of iniquity. Now, one of the things that Donald Trump got reelected on past election had to do with restoring justice to the United States of America. Law and order, common sense morality, upholding the Constitution and the laws that Congress have made, especially as it relates to border security and getting those who are illegally in our country out, especially those who are a danger to American citizens. And he has he's really followed through on his campaign promises, to the chagrin of many people on the left who just cannot stand him. And I was reading in my quiet time just the other day, 2 Kings chapter 23. It's the story of King Josiah and the reforms that he made. And it says about King Josiah, you know, Judah, the nation of Judah, the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, things weren't going well. When he took the throne, just as an eight-year-old boy in 640 BC, the nation was at a low point morally, militarily, economically, and especially spiritually. And he brought in tremendous reforms. The temple was restored. They rediscovered the law and began to practice that. The covenant was renewed. He destroyed the pagan altars, the high places, the idols of Baal and the Asherah across Judah and Samaria. He removed corrupt priests. He centralized the worship back to Jerusalem. They celebrated the Passover. He eliminated occult practices, brought about moral and social reforms. And as I was reading that, it's like, you know, just inside it said, Trump is doing a lot of these things. Obviously, Trump is not a king, and Trump is not all in for the Lord, you know, in the same way King Josiah was, but a lot of parallels. And so I texted my friend Bill Federer and I said, do you see these parallels between Donald Trump and King Josiah? And he said, exactly, I do. And so I've invited my friend Bill Federer, renowned historian, best-selling author, nationally recognized speaker, and a man who's dedicated to exploring America's historical and Christian heritage. And I want to have this discussion from King Josiah to President Trump, a discussion with Bill Federer. Bill, welcome to the program today.
Hey, Jeff. Great to be with you.
Well, I appreciate you so much, my friend. I like the way that you know more about history than anybody I've ever met. And I like the way you connect the dots. And so when I was reading about King Josiah, obviously Trump is not a king, but there are a lot of similarities between what Donald Trump wants to do to make America great again and what King Josiah did way back when in the 600s BC. Do you think that is too much of a stretch to say that those are similar?
No, I think that's an accurate comparison. Manasseh was the wicked king, served 55 years, and he was sacrificing children to Moloch. And the prophets come to him and tell him, you are doing the things that the people that were here before Israel came in were doing, sacrificing children. And because they were doing that. I brought Israel in to judge them, and because you're doing it, I'm going to drive you out. And judgment was pronounced. God said, it's over, I'm done with. Matter of fact, you look at every pagan culture in the world, they sacrificed children. The Greeks had exposure of unwanted infants. The Romans did. The Pacific Islanders and the Caribbean islands, they would sacrifice humans. American Indians, the Aztecs, would take captured tribes to the top of their pyramids and rip their beating heart out to the sun god. And about 5 years ago, they were excavating in Mexico City and underneath of a building that needed its foundation shored up, and they discovered a almost a theater-sized room full of skulls, and a lot of them baby skulls. So they weren't captives from war; they were ritual sacrifices. The Chinese in India, they would kill baby daughters because they wanted a male son. And so here is Manasseh. He's doing these pagan things, killing innocent children. God's a just God, and there's nothing more unjust than killing an innocent baby that didn't do anything wrong. I mean, we even use that as the innocent as a newborn babe, mm-hmm. right? It's the epitome of innocence. And so when you allow the killing of an innocent, what's a just God supposed to do? That's unjust. And so the prophets say it's over. His son dies, but his grandson's Josiah. 8 years old when he becomes king, a teenager, he starts to seek the Lord. And in his early 20s, he tells him to clean out the temple that his granddad had trashed. And they discover the law of God. Josephus, the Jewish commentator, said it was the last copy of the law on planet Earth because Manasseh was not just killing babies, he was destroying copies of the law. They read it to this young king. Supposedly, it was the original one Moses had wrapped in burlap, buried in under a bunch of stuff in the storage room of the temple. Well, they read it to this young king, and he rips his garments and repents, and he sends messengers to a prophetess in town named Huldah, the wife of the king's tailor. And Huldah tells the messengers, tell the man that sent you that judgment is coming, but not during his lifetime, because he repented when he heard the words of the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so judgment was put off for the entire 31-year reign of Josiah. And so Josiah has the biggest Passover ever. That's what the scripture says. And he has people coming from all over, not just Judah, but remnants from Israel. And they come and have this big Passover, the biggest one ever. It was almost like a rally.
Yeah.
Right?
It really was.
Rally. And then Josiah tears down Sodomite temples. In other words, he gets rid of this trans agenda, this mm-hmm. Sexual confusion agenda, and then he reforms the Department of Education. It's like, stop teaching that nonsense to the kids, and he sends the Levites out to teach the law. And it was during that revival, you compare the timeline, that's when Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were young boys, and they got taught the law. And so, but we see that Josiah's reformation was top down. Mm-hmm. It was great, but it was top down, and it never reached the bottom layers of society. How do we know? Well, after Josiah dies, and you have King Jehoahaz, and then King Jehoiakim, and then Jehoiakin, and then Zedekiah, and they're taken captive to Babylon, and Jeremiah is with the remnant of the remnant, and they're in Egypt. And they're still worshiping the Queen of Heaven. And the late ladies are weaving their things. And they, well, we're not doing this without our husbands knowing about it. And the husband says, yeah, as long as we worship the Queen of Heaven, everything was fine. It's when we stopped worshiping her that we got drove out.
Right.
And Jeremiah's like, no, God was patient with you while you were worshiping these pagan idols. And he's finally had enough. And you're still doing it. Mm-hmm. And so why is this important? Because I think Trump is doing a top-down reformation. Right, he's holding big rallies. He's getting rid of the trans agenda. It's a male and a female, and then he's reforming education. But he's doing it top down. Unless the pastors get their church members to rush in and fill the gap, it's like in military terms, you have an air war where planes fly and knock out strategic cannons and so forth. But you need the ground troops to go in and occupy. You need the Christians to go in and get involved in every area of society. And in my book, go ahead.
Well, what does that look like, Bill, practically? Because I think a lot of churches, I mean, pastors that are love the Lord and love our country, and it's okay to love our country, we cheer what we see Trump doing, because he is returning us to a place of law and order and moral sanity, and he's eradicating all these idolatrous practices and all this paganism that has just kind of oozed out of all the just the insanity and the satanic nature of all these things that we see taking place. I mean, these people that are so unhinged, that's not normal and that's not sane. And so he's dealing with that. But I think a lot of pastors don't know, what do I do? How do I mobilize? How do I capitalize on that? What would you say to that, Bill?
Right. Well, background, I've shared it before in my book, Silence Equals Consent, The Sin of Omission. 1600s, you had pastors and churches founding cities. Literally, the pastor and the church would found the city. So Providence, Rhode Island was founded by Pastor Roger Williams and the First Baptist Church in America. Everybody's involved in church and everybody's involved in city government because it's the church founding the city. Hartford, Connecticut was founded by Pastor Thomas Hooker and the First Congregationalist Church in America. Everybody's involved in church. Everybody's involved in city government. Every politician is a church member, right? And so they had one building in town called the Meeting House. That's where the pastor would teach the Bible, and that's where they would do their city business. The word synagogue means meeting house. That's where the rabbi would teach the law, and that's where they would do their city business. And so it worked. It's called a covenant form of government. But then you have, they get a little dry, and they teach it at Harvard and Yale academically. And some says God has it so planned out that in his infinite wisdom, he already knows who's going to wind up in heaven, so don't even bother preaching the gospel. And they became unevangelistic, and they got nicknamed Old Lights. And David Brainerd got expelled from Yale because he said his professor was as spiritual as a chair. So in the 1700s, a century later, you got the New Lights. And they said it's more than a plan. Even if it's a good plan, you have to have an experience with Jesus. And when you do, your life will change and you won't do worldly things anymore, like bars and brothels and government. Wait, what was that last thing? Yeah, government, it's worldly. If you're really Christian, you're not going to be involved in it. Mm-hmm. That came from Germany. Martin Luther breaks from Rome, and the German princes says, kingdom of mine, I just made the decision. You're all Lutherans. And the people in the kingdom are like, okay, well, what do we believe? And so it may not have been the same personal experience Martin Luther had. It's just a new state doctrine. So this revival movement starts called Pietism that says being a Christian is more than doctrine. You have to have this experience with Jesus. And when you do, you're going to withdraw from worldly things like government. It actually helped the Moravians get into countries around the world because they would assure kings, hey, we're not going to mess with your government. But they didn't realize in America, we're a republic and the citizens are the king. And when you're using this message, don't get involved, you're producing a negligent king. Mm-hmm. And so the Moravians influenced John Wesley, who influenced George Whitefield, who influenced this Great Awakening Revival, which is great. People are coming to the Lord, but it has this new thought that if you're really spiritual, you'll withdraw from government. Mm. And it's sort of, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Don't get involved in government because it's worldly. Well, why is it worldly? Because we're not involved in government. All the Christians have left and left a vacuum, and into it are sucked non-Christians. And you know, if you think of it, they're teaching in school that there's no God, and that if he does exist, he's messed up putting men in women's bodies. And you have to have operations and lifetime of pharmaceuticals to fix it. And if that behavior is not sin, what behavior? Well, sex outside of marriage. You know the little library books they show the kids? Try this kind of sex. Try that kind. If sex outside of marriage is not a sin, arguably there are no sins. And if there's no sins, you don't need a savior to save you from your sins. Mm-hmm. They're undermining the entire gospel. You have to admit it's a pretty clever trick the devil's pulled to get Christians who believe the gospel of Christ, let their children be taught the gospel of Antichrist. Yeah. We're so spiritual, we don't want to get involved in politics, so we're going to let worldly people teach our kids there's no God, there's no sin, and there's no need for a savior. It's like, wow, you're really spiritual, aren't you? But the idea is that a good man leaves an inheritance to his children. Right. So my counsel is children. A scriptural case can be made that God cares about children.
Yeah, Bill, let me cut in here. We're up against a break. You're listening to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here talking to renowned historian Bill Federer. Don't go away.
This is Real Truth for Today. Podcasts of the program are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Pastor Jeff Shreve.
Welcome back to the program. Pastor Jeff here with historian Bill Federer. We're talking about the similarities between the reforms from way back when under King Josiah in Israel. He was king from 640 BC until his death in 609 BC, and the connection between what he did in Judah and what Donald Trump is doing and campaigned to do in America. And if you want to watch us live, you can go to Facebook or YouTube and just type in American Family Radio, or go to AFR.net and you can watch and you can see Bill's smiling face. And it's always more fun. But if you're in the car or someplace that you can't do that, just continue to follow along. Okay, Bill, we have a statement that's been around for a long time because President Trump made it popular. Make America great again. What do you say for those that say, well, I don't like that statement because when was America ever great? It wasn't great for me. And so what year are we going back to when America was great?
When you got to be in charge of your life, right? And so the most common form of government in world history is kings. And a king is a glorified gang leader. And it's a hierarchical system. If you are friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the king, you are less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason, or you're a slave. And so from Nimrod, Pharaoh, Caesars, Kaisers, Sultans, Tsars, Maharaj, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar, Attila the Hun, the kingdoms keep getting bigger and bigger until the king of England had the biggest. And if you were a royalty, an elite, and you're in with the king, oh, you're special. You're a sir or a knight. And if you're not, you don't get that. And if you're an enemy of the king, forget it. It's over. And so America's founders didn't like that. And they broke away and flipped it and made the people the king. And so you're a king of your life with a little k, and then all of us are king of the country, and we have the free will opportunity of submitting our lives to Jesus, the King of Kings, right? And the difference is between pre-King Saul and post-King Saul. So the kings of Europe look to the Bible, but they look to the King Saul and on. I'm the royal, divinely appointed gang leader, and Saul turned around and killed most of the priests, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the Pilgrims and Puritans and Baptists and Presbyterians and Quakers and Congregationalists that founded New England, they looked to the pre-King Saul part of the Bible, where they had a covenant with God. And there's no king, right? You get rights from God. You're fair to your neighbor because you're accountable to God. The verse everybody knows is what? Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself. Mm-hmm. Do you know the verse immediately before it? Confront your neighbor directly so you'll not incur their guilt upon you. They're loving each other and they're confronting each other. It's like a parent, you love your kid, but every now and then you got to correct them. Because there was no king for 400 years in Israel. Everyone was taught the law. Everyone helped enforce the law. You had a responsibility to be involved in the community. Every man was in the militia. And so if the community was attacked, you were responsible to get out there and defend your wife and family and community. And so this covenant form of government is what the pilgrims look to, and they taught it at. So if you like being in charge of your life, if you like making decisions, if you like being able to speak your mind without fear of the government busting in your house and dragging you away for treason, then you like wanting to make America great again. If you want to submit your life to a deep state bureaucracy, and you know, there's six phases to this. For most of world history, kings were over the government and the religion, right? Nebuchadnezzar, I'm the king and I'm gonna blow my trumpets. You bow to my statue and worship it. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you have a warm feeling in your heart for my statue, right? But then the Roman emperors, they wanted to be the king, but they also said, take a little pinch of incense and drop it into this little fire in front of the statue of the emperor as an act of worship. And so Jesus says, render to Caesar what Caesar and God's was God. Jesus delineated that God's kingdom is different than the state. It's above it. And mm-hmm. So you had the church come along, and you had the popes. And so the split happened. Instead of the king being top down over the government and top down over the beliefs of the country, now It's split, and the Pope was top down over the church. So we have two for 1,000 years, and the kings would always want to appoint the bishops, like, you know, and then, but the popes would always threaten to excommunicate the king. But there was this initial division of taking power away from the king. And then you have a Reformation, and the church moves from a top-down church to a bottom-up church. Mm-hmm. It coincided with the invention of the printing press. So everybody could have their own Bible, and the pastor, instead of you listening to the pastor reading the scriptures in Latin, you could have your own copy, and the pastor saw his job as helping everybody to have a direct relationship with God the Father through Jesus Christ that died on the cross to pay for their sins. And then the pastor coaches each individual to become a mature Christian. You get in the habit of reading through the Bible yourself. Mm-hmm. And then as the church members' knowledge of the Bible grows, they can get involved in ministry. And so everybody plugs in and does something, nursery, children's nurse, junior high, because every muscle that's alive has to be exercised, right? You don't just take in, you take in and give out. So instead of it being a spectator religion where you're watching somebody else do the ministry, it's Ephesians 4 where the pastor trains you to do the work of the ministry. And so the pilgrims were coming across to America, and instead of going to Virginia, they're blown off course to Massachusetts. And the captain says it's too dangerous to sail anymore. Get off the boat. And the guy, they say, well, who's going to be in charge? There's no king-appointed person, 102 of us. And so they take their covenant church form of government, and they make it their civil government. So now we go from the king ruling the church and the state top down, and then we have 1,000 years where the state is ruled top down by a king, and then the church is ruled top down by a pope. But now we have the Reformation where the church is ruled bottom up, but then with the pilgrims, you have the state begins to be ruled bottom up. And so in New England, you had this covenant form of government that turned into our Constitution. The word federal is Latin for covenant. We have a covenant form of government where it's we the people ruling our government bottom up. Mm-hmm. And it works until the concept came that you should, when you get saved, you're going to withdraw from worldly things, including government. And so, mm-hmm. gee, all the Christians now begin to remove themselves from government. So who's left to be involved in government? Non-Christians, ambitious people, what are they going to do? They're not going to be content with ruling government bottom up. They're going to be ambitious and wanting to rule government top down. And then they're not going to be content with ruling the government top down. They're going to want to rule the church top down and say when you can have church, when you can't, and you got to not sing songs, and we're going to arrest your pastor.
Right.
And so we're back to where we started, right?
And with Nebuchadnezzar. That switch came in the first Great Awakening in the 1700s?
Right, this idea that it's more than a covenant plan. You're going to withdraw from worldly things, including the worldly government.
Right.
And
if you had to, like when Trump says, make America great again, in his mind, I have never seen him put a date on that, but what is he going back to? Is he going back to the 1950s and 60s?
I mean, I would say Teddy Roosevelt, right? And so this is where we had 95% tariffs. And so the country was just unbelievably prosperous. It's called the Gilded Age.
Okay.
Slavery was gone at this time. You had, even black millionaires. You had Booker T. Washington's the president of Tuskegee. You have, things are going great, of course. But then you have the Democrat racism that begins to creep in, and mm-hmm. and the Democrats form the KKK and all the other kind of stuff. But this period, Teddy Roosevelt was condemning this racism. He was condemning lynchings. He was condemning that. But you had the Democrats, again, pushing this. And then Margaret Sanger in 1916 starts pushing abortion. And but it's not a hardware problem. It's a software problem. But the period of the late 1900s and 1800s and early 1900s, America, it had the steel-sided ships, which before other countries did, and so we had the best Navy in the world, and Teddy Roosevelt sent our Navy, Dewey, to go over to Japan, and we're flexing our muscles, and we helped free Cuba from Spain, and so we're a force for good in the world, mm-hmm. and But that's probably the point. But, you know, I wanted to go back to one other point. Children. We all know Jesus cares about children. Mm-hmm. And, a generation ago, there were bus programs. And churches would send people through the neighborhoods around the church saying, hey, can we take your kid to Sunday school? And the I met a lady, she's 50, but she was 8 years old, and the Baptist church came by and knocked on the door. Can we take it? And she said that, yeah, they came by with the bus and took me to school, and I heard the gospel and got saved. And she looked, she says, that's when I got saved, 8 years old. And so the idea was that God loves all the children, not just the ones that come to the church, but the ones in the neighborhood around the church. Well, doesn't Jesus still love those kids? And shouldn't we care what those kids are being taught in the school? Mm-hmm. And that they're being taught that a boy can be a girl, and you can mutilate them and have a hysterectomy on little eight-year-old girls. And then you see these detransition videos where these girls are crying and they're saying, mm-hmm. I rejected being a woman before I knew what a woman was. And
right.
And so the school board races. More people go to church in an area than vote in a school board race. It's a doable thing. And it's just as easy as saying, look, we don't agree with every church on every doctrine, but none of us are in favor of this anti-biblical. I mean, here are teachers who cannot even define woman.
Right.
If they think they can tell that the little boy is supposed to transition to be a little, you can't even define girl. And right. Jesus said, if you allow one of these little ones who believes in me to stumble, better than a millstone be put around your neck. So it's a doable thing. Forget all the other races, just school board races. Mm-hmm. And I believe that if churches can care about what the kids are being taught, all the higher races will take care of themselves.
Bill, what do you think about Trump's use of tariffs? You had mentioned tariffs under Teddy Roosevelt. Do you think this is a good plan of his, or maybe a half-baked plan?
Yeah, so I wrote a book called The Interesting History of Income Tax, and I've done interviews on Real America Voices and on Victory News on this topic, because my degree is in accounting. Industrial Revolution. You had England burned coal. Coal came from mines. Mines would fill up with water. So in 1769, James Watt developed a steam pump to pump water out of coal mines. It quickly turned into a steam engine that ran factories, and they could make bolts of cloth instead of a lady sitting at a spinning wheel making thread. But Britain didn't want to have manufacturing in America in the colonies. So when the revolution starts, we break from Britain, and in our Constitution, it says, Article 1, Section 8, that the federal government will get its money through imposts on imports. They're called tariffs. And so the federal government had no power to tax the people. That did not come into place until 1913 with the 16th Amendment. The federal government had no power to tax the people. How's the federal government going to get its money? Through tariffs on imports. So the second bill George Washington signed was a 5% tariff on all imports, the 1789 Tariff Act. And what about a country wanting to sneak its ships into America without going through a port so they don't have to pay the tariffs? That's when the Secretary of Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, invented the Coast Guard. And the fastest ships of the day were called cutters, and so they were called revenue cutters, real fast ships that would catch these boats trying to smuggle stuff into goods without paying the tariff. Mm-hmm. And so then after the War of 1812, tariffs go up to 25%. By the Civil War, they're up to like 90%. And you have Thomas Jefferson, 1816. He says, it may do for a while for everyone to sacrifice and pay these imposts on tariffs, on imports, to give us the opportunity to encourage manufacturing to be developed on our own soil. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to make European goods more expensive, it'll give us an impetus for us to do the Industrial Revolution. And it was the fastest rise in the standard of living in human history. And it mostly freed up women. So instead of the woman having to sit at this wheel, if you get wool and look at it under a microscope, it has little barbs that if you pull them together, they get tighter the tighter you pull them. And so it turns into thread. And so the women would have to take this yarn and just pull it, and then they would wrap it through this wheel, spinning wheel, and then they would pull it, and then they would have to weave the thread into cloth, and then they would have to sew the cloth. But with the Industrial Revolution, they could buy an entire bolt of cloth, or get this, even ready-to-wear clothes. Wow. And then instead of the woman having to go to the well and bring water in to wash with a tub, they could have indoor plumbing and have a washing machine. Mm-hmm. Instead of outhouses, right, you could have indoor plumbing. And so it freed women up from this. It was the fastest rise in the standard of living in human history.
So are you for them, the tariffs that Trump is imposing?
Yeah. He's basically returning us to the time when we became the richest country in the world. And so, even 1921, the United Peanut Growers Association asked George Washington Carver to go from Tuskegee to Washington, D.C. and lobby for a tariff on peanuts imported from China. Why? Because they were bringing them in so cheap, nobody was buying the southern peanuts. And so he was successful. So in 1922, they passed the Ford and McCumber Tariff Act, making the Chinese peanuts more expensive so people would buy the peanuts from America South, and it prospered all the farmers and all the freed blacks who were farming peanuts down in the South. And but the movement toward income taxes, most of the tariffs were collected at southern ports, like Charleston, South Carolina. Matter of fact, when the South threatened to not collect the tariffs, that's when Lincoln sent the troops to Fort Sumter to force them, and that's when they fired on Fort Sumter. And then when the Civil War started, there's no tariff income from the South because they're rebelling. And so suddenly Lincoln's federal government has no money. So he pushes through an emergency income tax to raise $750 million to pay for the war. After the war's over, the Southern states are back in. We can go back to collecting tariffs. The income tax is repealed. Then you have some German immigrants coming over, and they're organizing unions, and they're demanding redistribution of wealth because of Marxism that they were infected with. And so there's this movement to have an income tax on the wealthy.
Yeah.
But the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional in 1894.
Hold that thought, Bill. We're up against a break. You're listening to Real Truth for Today. Pastor Jeff Shreve here talking to historian Bill Federer. We'll be right back. Because of the generous donations provided from listeners just like you, Preborn has rescued over 330,000 babies. But every day, the abortion industry is taking thousands of babies' lives. We have to save them. So please donate your best gift to save more babies at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
If you'd like to contact Pastor Jeff, email PastorJeff@FromHisHeart.org. Now, back to Real Truth for Today with Pastor Jeff Shreve.
Welcome back to the program. Pastor Jeff here. We're talking to historian Bill Federer. We're comparing the reforms of King Josiah, who lived in the 640s BC, and he was king at the age of 8. And really made significant and good and godly reforms to the nation of Judah. Judah was in bad shape when he took the throne, and he was zealous for the Lord and was zealous for righteousness. And the scripture says that the execution of justice is joy for the righteous, but is terror to the workers of iniquity. And so we've been comparing King Josiah to what Donald Trump wants to do to return America to a place of sanity, to a place of law and order, to make America great again. Bill, I want to play a clip for you and have you comment on it. It's Donald Trump talking in an interview, and he mentions Trump derangement syndrome that infects and affects so many people. Let me play it for you.
Just some advice, because you come under fire a lot. Our moms are standing for things that often the media attacks them on. We'd love to get some advice from you about running for office.
Yeah, so I would say don't do it.
No, run for office. We want you to run for office.
I do say this, though. It is nastier to run as a Republican. It is. Now, I'm the ultimate, you know, I mean, they suffer from a thing called TDS, do you know what that is?
Yes.
TDS, it's a horrible, horrible terminal disease. It destroys the mind. It destroys the mind before the body, but the body eventually goes. TDS is Trump derangement syndrome. They have it at levels. They can't even stand their life. They can't stand anything. And, you know, part of the reason is I won an election, which everybody said couldn't be won.
Okay, Bill, Trump derangement syndrome. Has that been a surprise to you how that is so widespread?
No, I wrote a book called Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present, and it's a socialist tactic, and it's based on marketing. So in the 1800s, you had Sears catalog, and you'd know everything about a Singer sewing machine, and you make an informed purchase. But in the early 1900s, you had magazine ads, and you would buy something knowing nothing about it, but the ad just made it look like everybody liked it and was happy. And so the person that invented this was Edward Bernays. He's the nephew of Sigmund Freud, the psychoanalyst that discovered that we're social creatures. We want to fit in. We do not want to be rejected. And so it turned into the whole fashion industry that you see somebody with something and you want to fit in and you'll wear it. And so Edward Bernays wrote a book called The Engineering of Consent. So we're a government from the consent of the government. What if you could engineer consent and make it look like everybody is holding a certain view? So instead of selling shoes, you're selling an ideology. Mm-hmm. But it's all based on canceling the voices that you don't like and then making it feel like you want to fit in. And so you're going to adopt these other political views. And now it's called social emotional learning. And so they tie the emotion with the behavior change, and then it's cemented. They discovered this during the Korean War. So World War II, soldiers came out and they were happy to be in America. Remember Hogan's Heroes and The Great mm-hmm. Escape and things like that. But the Korean War, they did something different. They would isolate the prisoners for days, weeks, months, until they craved wanting another human interaction. Just wanting to be with the buddies and a slap on the back, and they would bring him into a room of guys who had already caved. And before they could be accepted in the group and get that emotional reinforcement they wanted, they had to reject America. And once they said, yeah, America's bad, America terrible, and they go, oh yeah, you're one of us now, great, oh, you're a buddy. And so they learned how to do this nationally. And so they would isolate people for days, weeks, months in their homes, and social distance them. So until they got to this vulnerable spot, I just crave wanting to get back to, just want to go out to dinners, want to go shopping, just want to talk to people. And when they're at this vulnerable spot, they say, yeah, but before you can be accepted, you got to inject this into your body, wear this on your face, hey, let us track you everywhere you go. And you're like, fine, whatever. I just want to get back to normal. And right, because you want that. So they've weaponized that in the classroom. So here's Disney pushing hundreds of millions of dollars of product. And it's all based on what? Convincing a child to want something. So you have frozen t-shirts, frozen pajamas, frozen band-aids, frozen, you know, Happy Meals, whatever. And these kids see other kids with it, and they see it everywhere, and they want it. Mm-hmm. And so the kids want to be accepted chosen for the team, and they don't want to be not invited to the party. And so they now call it the pyramid of oppression. And they go into the classroom, and they have the cisgendered, that's what they call somebody who believes there is a male and a female. Mm-hmm. And they're at the top of the pyramid, they're the oppressors. And then down the pyramid are the asexual, bisexual, transsexual, pansexual, anything sexual, and they're being oppressed by the oppressors. And then they ask the kids, which ones are you? Well, nobody's gonna pick the oppressor. So right. They pick anything else. There's been a 5,000% increase in trans, non-binary identifying children in the last, 4 years under the previous administration. Right. And it works. Kids want to be accepted. So they've weaponized that. This fear of being rejected, they call it social emotional learning, behavior modification. And it's all based on this marketing concept that you want to wear the tennis shoes that other people wear. You want to wear the t-shirts and you want to be invited to the parties. And so once it gets into your emotion, you don't think logically anymore. Mm-hmm. And the best way I explain it is there's high school teams and they're playing. And I ask you, which one are you rooting for? Well, let's see. I'm going to look at the players here, players there. But if one of those schools is your alma mater, you're going to be for that school, no matter if they're good or bad, because you have an emotional attachment to them.
Right.
And so once they can get you to emotionally attach to a view, then logic is out the window. And so they call that Trump derangement syndrome. Once they get people to emotionally identify with this counter culture type of thing, then there's no amount of logic that you can use to try to convince them otherwise.
Okay, Bill, but we didn't really see that with, let's say, George Bush. It didn't seem like people were just insane when it came to George Bush. You mentioned Donald Trump's name in a group of people. Elon Musk said this not too long ago. He said he was at a party and he mentioned Trump's name. This was before Trump was reelected. And he said people just went berserk on him. He said, I just mentioned his name. Do you think Trump's the first president to have that kind of effect on people?
I think there's been other ones, but it comes with a clear distinction. So you had Teddy Roosevelt was Make America Great Again. Woodrow Wilson, he was a globalist. He wanted to start the League of Nations to have world peace after World War I, but it would require all the nations to surrender their sovereignty to a globalist entity. And Americans rejected that. We're not going to surrender. And so a lot of those globalists, I sort of skipped past it, but income tax. So Woodrow Wilson pushed through the first income tax. It was a 1% tax on the top 1% richest people in the country. Well, rich people aren't rich because they're stupid. They're rich because they're smart and they know how to avoid taxes. So they started tax-free foundations, Carnegie Foundation, Ford Foundation, so they could still control their money. They just weren't taxed on it. But the Democrats kept pushing for more taxes until finally FDR, he raised the taxes through the roof and it created something called outsourcing. Gee, squeeze the sponge, water goes out. You raise the taxes on businesses, the businesses are going to leave and go to other countries where there's cheap labor, no lawsuits, no red tape, government bureaucracy, and then they're going to produce stuff cheaper and then take their profits and lobby politicians to lower the tariffs so they can bring their goods back into America cheaper. This is called free trade. Mm-hmm. And when they sell it cheaper, they put out of business American businesses until Americans are dependent on the foreign stuff. And then when it comes time to negotiating foreign trade, they can say threaten to withhold their products unless we cave. And so from Woodrow Wilson on, you had the Democrats getting money from globalists and some rhino Republicans getting money from these globalists. And so they wanted this free trade and they wanted to let the other countries make the profits. And so their allegiances were split. And so once the businesses went overseas, their patriotism went with them. And so we call these people globalists. And so you have a lot of politicians that are not thinking wanting to preserve America, they're in being financially influenced by globalists who have lots of money and they can funnel it into their reelection campaigns and so forth. So some of the Republican candidates over the years have been giving really good speeches, but their policies have been enabling this free trade globalism. And mm-hmm. Trump's come along and said, enough of that. I'm not a globalist. I'm not for a one world government antichrist. I want a strong America. Mm-hmm. And so the people that have been more or less bought out don't like that. And
Bill, were you surprised that he got reelected?
Yeah, I thought they were going to rig it so that he wouldn't. I ran for Congress 3 times about 20 years ago. And I ran against Dick Gephardt, who was the House Minority Leader. He was the Nancy Pelosi before Nancy Pelosi. So it was the most expensive congressional race in Missouri history. And he drained $9 million out of the Democrat Leader's Victory Fund and spent it against me, which I guess is sort of a badge of honor that somebody would spend $9 million trying to destroy you. And but on election day, we had people calling our office that my name was accidentally left off the ballot in 5 wards in the city of St. Louis. People went in to vote for me. My name wasn't there. And then we were ahead and the electricity goes off at the Board of Election. And when they reboot, we're behind. And then we have a volunteer at the Hillsboro Board of Election checking off the precincts. And they said they can't find the box of ballots from Guffey Elementary School. which was the largest precinct in the county that I personally stood in front of for 8 hours in the cold. And I'm like, you're telling me they can't find a box of ballots? And in all this confusion, my opponent gets on TV, announces he won. I'm like, they didn't even count that whole county. That was what was going to put me over the top. And my wife said I was the crash dummy for what they did to Trump. Anybody that thinks there's not voter fraud, you try, just run for office and then check back with me. You'll experience similar things like that. Mm-hmm. So they even had a guy named Robert D. Odom that claimed he went in to vote and his name was not on the registered voter list. And so he supposedly filed a lawsuit and the federal judge ordered the polls to stay open till midnight on Election Day. And so we go down there and there's all these street people lined up around the block. And the next day they find out that that Robert D. Odom had died 2 years earlier. And it's like, what? Who filed the lawsuit? Well, somebody in the Democrat Party. And they said, well, we'll promise to fix it. So next time it won't happen. It's like, what do you mean next time?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And so when you spend in total 6 years of your life campaigning, going to hundreds of meetings, shaking hands, raising money, and then each time on election night, some shenanigans happen. So I think that they definitely did those type of things to Trump. I was hoping that he would get elected, and I think that it was too big to rig. I think that there was such an overwhelming response that he outdid their plans. And I did talk to a gentleman who was in Virginia, and he said that they got word that they were going to be doing dumps in these drop-off boxes, and you're only supposed to drop off your own ballot. And so the church got men to sit in their lawn chairs and their iced tea and their cell phones and they're, you know, listening to music and they're just sitting, you know, near the drop-off boxes. And when somebody gets out of their car with boxes of ballots, they just pull out their phone and they were just filming. And then the person sees they're being filmed. They turn around and get in the car. They drive to another drop-off box. There's another guy sitting there with their lawn chairs, another one. Then they call their boss and says, well, where do I drop these off? I get paid, you know, $15 per ballot or whatever it is.
Right.
And then it turns 7 o'clock and there's no more drop-offs. And it caught them. So they weren't able to do their fraud. And then you had Charlie Kirk, and he said, hey, if they're going to harvest ballots, let's have churches harvest ballots. So in California, you had churches going through the training, and they were collecting the ballots, and they were not. And so we played a hard game, and it worked, and Trump got in. But I think that if we sit back, and if the midterms, if they can win just a couple congressional seats and put in Hakeem Jeffries as speaker, it's immediate impeachment trials.
Right.
And if they ever get back in as president, they'll do one executive order, reverse everything Trump did, and we're in an Antichrist scenario. And the illogical vehemence that they have. And we can see this in communist China. I was talking to somebody in India, and the radical Hindu government is wiping out Christian villages. We see this in North Korea and in Iran. The persecution of Christians. They're itching to do that in America.
Well, we need to be praying for sure. And so I appreciate Bill Federer so much. Bill, thanks for coming on today. We are out of time. But thank you for listening to Real Truth for Today with Pastor Jeff Shreve. It's a joy and a privilege to be your host and to come to you every day. Go out today, shine for Christ, share what great things the Lord has done for you, and God will use you as His witness. God bless you.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.